This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont's Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb says we need to think hard about the system of special education we've created over the years in Vermont. In some schools and school districts, special ed students spend 75% of their class time away from their peers in one-on-one educational sessions with para and special educators. For some students, that might be necessary, but Holcomb and others say that for most students, it's not necessarily the best way to learn. The secretary told the House Education Committee earlier this year that the situation is unacceptable. So what would be better, and how are special education costs affecting the overall tab for educating Vermont students? We're going to talk about both of those things today. I'm joined now by Bill Talbot, Chief Financial Officer for the Vermont Agency of Education. Hello, Bill. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Ned Kirsch, Superintendent of Franklin West Supervisory Union. Thanks to you for being here, Ned.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Bill.
Ned, my kids are little, very little. One of them's not born yet. So I don't have experience with this in Vermont classrooms. And I'm hoping that maybe you could tell me and tell our audience a little bit about what special education curriculum actually looks like and how it fits into a school day in your district.
Well, it varies, actually, in my district. And that's one of the reasons we're trying to make it better. You know, we're an SU. We have three separate school districts. So it's as much as we want to coordinate it, it's a little different in each school. And really the idea behind special ed services originally was to get those students who are in need kind of back up to speed where they need to be and on their way. And along the way, I think we've lost our way. And as Secretary Holcomb said, the environment has gone more to, you know, students who need special services are the ownership has gone to the special education teacher or paraeducator and away from the regular classroom teacher. And I think that's the quandary we're in right now in Vermont. And it's really, it's a culture that we've established that is, I think, driving up costs and really not serving the students we really want to serve.
So what does that look like then if education is sort of ceded to the paraeducator or the special educator rather than to the classroom educator who has that whole third grade classroom, for example? You know, what does that mean for a student who has been identified as needing some special help?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm speaking in generalities.
Absolutely.
I know there's some excellent examples all over the place, including my district, where classroom instruction is completely tailored to every kid in the class and they're getting that high-quality first instruction from either their teacher or specialist who's working alongside that teacher. But a lot of times, students who are in special ed, the belief of the teacher may be they're much better served if they're working with a special educator, or they're going to be better served if they're working directly with a paraeducator because, you know, there's 20 kids in my class right now, and I can't get all the services to him or her that I need. So if they just go out and work with that special educator, they're going to be so much better served. And I think that's the underlying philosophy of why we've gotten to this place where students who are in special ed are not really in the regular ed classroom as much as they should be and not receiving that instruction from a person who has the most knowledge in that area.
But what's the problem with that? In some ways, it sounds like the dream, one-on-one education, where, you know, if you're a student who perhaps learns differently from some of the other students in your classroom and you've got one person who can spend the day teaching you math and reading and science, why is that not?
Well, it's not the nirvana of education.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's start with paraeducators. Paraeducators are, you know, work really hard, want nothing but the best for the kids that they're working with, but they're also not our most highly trained staff members. You know, teachers have degrees in teaching. They may have specific subjects they're expert in. Paraeducators may have, you know, a high school diploma, but not much more past that and not as much, you know, some have teaching degrees. So there's the whole range, but they may not have targeted instructional knowledge in that area, and it's not they're very well-meaning. They're great people. They do a great service, but they may not have the skills necessary to help that student. They may be actually supporting them along the way, but they may not be really addressing their actual disability to help them overcome that disability. With special educators, it's similar. You know, special educators are experts in pedagogy, experts in special ed disabilities. They may not be expert in reading. They may be knowledgeable, but the classroom teacher may be far more expert in reading instruction. So that's one reason where it's not maybe educational nirvana, that they're going out in a small setting. Also, when you're in a setting, a one-to-one setting, one, it's expensive for everybody, but two, you know, you're isolated. For speech-language services, the Speech-Language Association says that kids shouldn't be served in one-on-one unless there's a specific reason. It should really be a three-to-one. Same with special ed. Group sizes shouldn't be one-to-one. But we find ourselves in my district, in many districts across the state, if you've read the UMass study from last year, many, many students are put in these one-to-one situations outside of the regular classroom without getting that great first instruction.
We're talking today about special education in Vermont, and we're looking at both the cost and the practice of it, and what works and what doesn't work, what might be done differently in Vermont to best serve our children and to deal with rising education costs, which may be two completely separate issues, or they could be connected. So we're going to look at all of that today. And we'd really love to hear from you, especially if you are somebody who has some experience with special education in Vermont. Tell us about what your family's experience was like, what you liked and didn't like, and what you think the best structure and support for Vermont kids would look like. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Bill Talbot, about one in six children in Vermont schools is identified as having special needs and qualifying for special education. Can you talk about maybe some of the issues that are categorized as special needs? I mean, what are we actually categorizing in terms of Vermont children who might need special education?
So if I understand correctly, it's a federal mandate. This is an entitlement program for kids with disabilities. The federal law identifies 13 separate disabilities. I can't name them, but I could name some of them. Ned probably could do it better than I could.
He's shaking his head no.
So Bill, I think you're on this one.
Okay. Oh, boy. Okay. But there's a process for identifying a student. First and foremost, you have to be shown to have a true disability. It has to be documented by a person with a credential, like a doctor. And then it has to be shown that it has an adverse impact on your education. And third, you have to be in need of specialized instruction. So we call those the three gates, and special educators are well-versed in them, and they go through the – when the student is identified, they go through the process. And if the student is deemed to meet all three gates, then a group of people called the Individualized Education Program Team meet, includes the parents, a representative from the school district, the special educators, and lay out this individualized education program, which prescribes just what this child should get. And so we range from emotional disabilities to learning disabilities, visual, hearing disabilities. Other health impairment would include the students with a hyperactive disorder. Autism is one of the categories, one of the 13 categories. What we've seen recently is a rise in the emotional disability category, which has been a little bit disturbing to us. We seem to be having a higher percentage in Vermont than in many states, if not most states. But that gives you a sense of how it works and the types of categories that we're looking at.
We got an email from one listener who says, I'm in my third year as a special education teacher in one of the larger high schools in central Vermont after teaching for 15 years in Pennsylvania. I first just want to say that basically everyone I meet in special ed and in general ed is compassionate, dedicated, and hardworking in trying to educate our young people today and help them be capable and empowered contributors to society. It seems that Vermont has one of the most exacting processes for determining special education eligibility in the country. There are these three gates, which, Bill Talbot, you mentioned, and this listener names them disability, adverse effect, and need, and the huge amount of effort that goes into documenting those. And our listener says, I gather that this exactitude has led to neither lower identification rates nor better outcomes. And is it true, Bill Talbot, that Vermont has a pretty high rate of students who qualify for special education?
Yes, actually it's true. What's interesting is that as our our student population has declined since about its peak in 1997. We're down some 23,000, 26,000 kids. The number of students identified for special ed has remained fairly constant. It's down a little bit. It's just below 14,000, 13,007, 13,008, I believe, is the number. And so you're dividing that number by the declining student population. We have a higher and higher percentage of kids who are included. It raises many questions. I don't know that we know the answer. We have some suggestions. We've been looking at it. Others are looking at it. Is it over-identification? I don't think so. There may be some instances where it can go either way, and the folks involved have to make a call, and they try to do it what makes most sense for the kid. The other thing is our K-12 population is down to, off the top of my head, 78,000 kids right now. The K-12 public school population down from about 103,000 in 97. And what's the profile of our population? Do we just have a needier population today? Our poverty numbers are up. A number of kids eligible for Medicaid are up. So we're wondering whether that's a concern. Is it just that we have a needier population today? Is it over-identification, or is it other factors? And we don't know those answers, but we are trying to look at them.
Ned Kirsch, as superintendent of Franklin West, you've thought about this, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the work you've been doing on trying to think about special education in your supervisory union. But what do you think about the reasons why Vermont has, in comparison to other states, so many kids who
qualify? Well, I think it's all three, what Bill just said. I mean, Vermont is 16%, and I think the national average is 12% right now. And
of kids who qualify for special education.
I think Bill's right where he said there are more students in need. That plays out in the school. We're certainly seeing the result of kind of the opiate epidemic that's going on in portions of our state with students who come to school with a significant amount of trauma. That certainly played into it. And, you know, I can only again speak to my own experience as an administrator, but, you know, when you're deciding whether or not a student goes into special ed and you're looking at those three gates and you're sitting at a table with teachers and parents, my experience has been that most times people are looking for a way to get a student onto special ed. I mean, some parents don't want it at all, but a lot of parents are dying for the extra help, and, you know, everyone wants to give that extra help, and it goes right back into the culture piece. Like, oh, if we just do this, we're going to make everything okay.
Because everybody wants their kids to succeed.
Absolutely. And every teacher, everyone, and we're all sitting around the table like, all right, giving them the specialized instruction will help them succeed. And I think that does lead to some over-identification.
Let's go to Matt, who's calling in today from Newport. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hi. Now, my experience with special ed has been that I was a student in special education classrooms multiple times throughout late middle school all the way through till high school. And I noticed that there were a lot of children in the special education classrooms around me who were in there for more behavioral issues than actual special needs. They were pulled out of regular classrooms to keep normalcy in the regular classrooms and keep everything organized in there. And they were really put over off to the side. And I was just wondering, what exactly are the criteria going to be to determine whether or not it's a behavioral issue versus an emotional disability?
Matt, thanks for your call. I appreciate hearing from you. Ned Kirsch, this must be something that you deal with.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have special ed classrooms anymore. So, you know, I'm not sure of Matt's exact experience, except for what he told us. You know, we try to reach every kid where they are. If they do have an emotional disturbance, that is a behavioral issue, but we don't just pull kids out of classes and put them other places. I mean, every kid who comes to our school is our kid. Every kid that comes to our school is their parents' best kid. They're not holding their best kids home. They're sending them to school, and it's our job to serve every one of those students. So we try not to, and I'm very strongly, not to just push kids aside, and we want to serve every kid. We feel like
granting that and understanding that that is true, and that's the sort of desire of any school district. If there is a child who's exhibiting behavioral issues that are disruptive to the rest of the classroom, what do you do? And is that something that then you call in special educators and paraeducators?
Right. That's when we start the process. You know, if we have to figure out through data and through what is going on with this particular student, because it could be a variety of things. I mean, just because a kid is acting out, and usually the kids who act out are boys. You know, to be girls usually act out in a different way. So, you know, it's pretty rare where you see a girl getting into a behavioral issue at school, disrupting a class, where it's much more common seeing a boy. They both may have the same underlying issues, but they play out differently in school. So they both take a lot of our attention, and we have to try to figure out what is going on with the student and how can we best serve them. Sometimes that means they go through the process of being identified or not identified for special education.
Let's go to Mark in Fletcher. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. Your turn.
How are you? Thank you for taking my call. As a longtime educator in Elijah Urban High School in Vermont, which will remain nameless, the relationship as a technical teacher with the general population, I felt as though certain tech classes were segregated and designated as dumping grounds for certain profile students. And those tech teachers and academic teachers were confronted with classroom dynamics that were confrontational and at times disruptive because students perceived that they were able to avoid certain disincentives or incentives for acting out because the special ed situation accommodated that at the expense of the general population. And by the time they got to high school, it was a well-oiled routine where students knew they could, you know, keep the disruptive ball going until one ran out of verbiage, somebody else would pick it up. And when a teacher tried to stop that by engaging special ed, they were branded as a less than, you know, less than good teacher. And my approach was always try to create a family situation and treat them like family. And if you weren't ready to do that, then you shouldn't be in that profession. But
Mark, thanks. I hear you and I appreciate your perspective. And it's, you know, it's interesting to hear about that dynamic in the classroom and how you deal with children who are exhibiting disruptive behaviors and when it's appropriate to call in somebody else. So I appreciate hearing that perspective from somebody who has been an educator for so long. I want to move along a little bit to funding, and we'll also take more calls and emails. But Bill Talbot, the funding formula for special education in Vermont, perhaps will surprise no one that it's not totally straightforward. Can you explain how it's paid for? I mean, schools right now are paying the salaries of professionals in special education, but they're getting some reimbursement from the state. Can you just briefly explain how that all works?
I will try. So it actually works a whole lot like insurance. We reimburse real time, on average, 60% of costs. I'm doing real high level here. Districts make claims during the year, and then we, from the state's education fund, we reimburse those costs. And it depends on what the claim is, the rate of reimbursement, but it does average about 60%. We spend over $300 million in total on special education. The feds chip in roughly $20 million. And so the balance of that is split 60-40 between the state and the districts.
So the total cost of special education in Vermont, including the federal money, state money, and district money?
Is I think around $305 million right now, plus or minus a little bit, yes.
Okay, and so as you said, some of that is coming from federal dollars, so some of that is not coming out of state property taxes.
That's right. About $20 million a year, varies a little bit, is covered by the federal government. And then the education fund, whose major source is property taxes, but other sources as well, the state's general fund, lottery money, sales tax, mm-hmm. Contribute to that. But that pays for the state 60%. And then the local districts, it's included in there, what we call their spending per pupil number, which sets their tax rates. But we do try to mitigate the effect on their tax rate by providing that 60% funding.
We are talking about special education in Vermont today, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that funding model and some potential changes that are being debated at the State House in Montpelier. We'll be joined by the House Education Chair in just a moment. And if you want to share your experience with special education in Vermont, or if you have a question for our guests, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're learning a little bit more about special education in Vermont, what it looks like in practice, and why so many more Vermont kids qualify for special ed compared to other states. If you want to share your family's perspective or experience, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking with the Chief Financial Officer for the Vermont Agency of Education, Bill Talbot, and with Ned Kirsch, who's the Superintendent of Franklin West Supervisory Union. And we have more of your thoughts and emails and calls to come. But we're joined right now by David Sharp, Chair of the House Committee on Education, which is looking at some potential changes to how special education is funded in Vermont and how we could get best practices in place in Vermont schools. Representative Sharp, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So your committee has been working on a bill that would look at best practices, as I mentioned, in special education and at the funding model. Can you first explain the changes you want to make in how special education is funded?
Sure. So we fund special education for the most part based on a reimbursement model. So I liken it to if I sent you out to the grocery store and agreed to pay half of what you purchased, your shopping practices might be different than if you had to pay the entire bill. So there are some inherent pressures inside the funding mechanism. To deal with those pressures and try to keep spending under control, we require an awful lot of documentation and proof from the school districts that they're actually spending this money legitimately on special education, which places a burden on school districts to do that documentation. So it may not be, we don't think it's the best way to fund special education. And we're looking at a census model that allots a block grant to a school district to deal with all the special education issues in their school, loosens the reporting restrictions somewhat, and allows more flexibility for the schools to do some of the best practices that we know are out there, but are difficult to use because of the funding mechanism.
Why would changing the funding mechanism from a reimbursement model to that block grant you're talking about allow schools more flexibility in implementing best practices?
Well, Ned Kirsch may be able to answer this better than I, but I'll give a shot at it. And so if you have a classroom of 15 students and you have three of those students that are on IEPs and need special attention with regard to math issues, for example, in a math class.
And just to remind people, IEPs are individual education plans, right? Maybe
correct.
Not quite that, saying that right.
Those are the accommodations that are made for special education students. And the teacher in the front of the class is teaching, division, long division. I don't know if that's taught anymore in schools, but that's what I learned. So let's say the teacher at the head of the class is teaching long division, and they're going through some practice problems. So what might be the best practice in that classroom is to have the classroom aide go to the front of the classroom and help the class work through the problems that the teacher has designed and set up for the students to work through, and then have the specialist, the math teacher, who is the best educator in the room, work with the three special education students. Right now, unless she has a special or he has a special education endorsement on the license, that money is not reimbursable. Furthermore, it's not reimbursable for the special education aide who has been working with these three students to work with the entire class. That neither is that reimbursable. So what might be the best practice for the math specialist to work with the three students who are struggling and have the aide work with the rest of the class in terms of working through some programs or problems that the teacher has designed for the class to work through. That is difficult for a school to implement without experiencing the inability to get reimbursed for those expenses.
I want to continue talking about best practices and funding, but I also want to make sure that we get some of our listeners' experiences and thoughts in here. Rebecca is calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Rebecca. Go right ahead.
Hi. So I have a kindergartner who's on an IEP, and I just want to point out that if it weren't for an incredible high-quality program, preschool program, and really wonderful EEE services, she would not be doing as well as she is now in kindergarten. And, you know, since she's been in the public school system, she hasn't been able to, she hasn't needed the special ed services that she would have if not for that really high quality child care. So just want to put it out there that child care is a huge support of, a supporter of helping us mitigate the special ed problem in K-12 schools.
Rebecca, thanks for your call. And I think one of the things that we may be able to get to is that idea of early intervention and how that can help in the process, both in saving costs, but also in educational outcomes. So I appreciate that. Let's hear from Leslie in Williston. Hi, Leslie.
Hi there. I just wanted to share that I have a 13-year-old son who has been on an IEP since he was in kindergarten. And he does have a low IQ. He is on autism spectrum. And thanks to the paraeducators and special educators in his life, that is what has kept him in school and not requiring a special placement or, in other words, a special school that could handle his behavioral problems, his academic challenges, and help him figure things out, because he takes a lot of time. And fortunately, because of the paraeducators and the special educators in place for him, he doesn't take away from the rest of the classroom.
So, Leslie, for you, it feels like this is the right mix, and your son is getting an education that he deserves and that is fair for him and works.
Yes, yes. I feel like Williston has been very fair to my son, and I'm very thankful that he's been able to stay mainstreamed.
Thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate you sharing your family's perspective. Let's hear one more here from Aaron in Salisbury. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead. You there, Aaron? All right, we'll see if we can come back to Aaron. We did get a note from Scott in Burlington who says $300 million a year, which is about what Vermont spends on special education, by 13,800 students is about $22,000 per student per year. Scott says, we have a child receiving special services, value these quite a bit, and feel that the extra attention has resulted in significant reading improvements. However, I wonder if we were offered a budget of $15,000 a year to seek external help for the child, we might have reached the same goal more efficiently. So Scott helping us turn back to this money question and the issue of funding models and how that affects what we're doing. And Representative Joe Sharp mentioned that Ned Kirsch, you might have some perspective on this that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of a block grant, which would allow schools to be innovative and creative in how we best meet the needs of students, would be a great idea. Because he's right. We are kind of stuck right now in the model that he was explaining, where a math specialist, you know, I'd have them working with more than just three kids, but having them work, they wouldn't be able to get any of that reimbursement. And, you know, the paraeducator who may not have that specialty, who in some places right now would have to work with them, would get the reimbursement. So I love the story about, you know, the grocery shopping, and you get, that's so true. You know, it's cost effective if you believe in the culture that we have right now to hire a paraeducator, because it's half the price. And, you know, the woman who called from Williston, I think that's awesome that her son is succeeding. And you know, I know that Chittenden South does a great job with that, but it is a continuum. You know, there's some kids who are always going to need that level of support so they can access school like her son, and we don't want to send kids to other schools. We want them to be in their hometown school. So I think that's a great thing. I think there's also the other end of the spectrum where we, as a system or school system, serve a lot of students with paraeducators who are mild to moderate need special ed students who need a lot more independence where we may not get them that independence. So that's really where I'm speaking of. I'm not really speaking to the other side where kids need a lot of extra support to succeed and it really helps them and their family. So I look at it as a continuum where I think on the side where we're serving mild to moderate needs the same way we're serving students with really high needs, we have to take a look at that.
Phil Talbot, how much would you say special education costs in Vermont are driving the education costs overall? I mean, how much of an issue is this in terms of looking at the cost of education in the state?
Well, recently, the growth rate in special ed costs have slowed down, but we've been doing the funding this way since the late 80s, like 89, I think this began. And it has become a bigger and bigger piece of the education pie because special ed costs grew faster than the total costs. So they were more of the driving a cost driver for education. Recently, that has slowed down, still a little bit higher than the total growth rate. We're seeing like maybe a 3% growth rate in special education, a little less than that totally. You know, I'm off a little bit, but it's close to that. We don't know really why it slowed down recently, but you figure at some point you reach a saturation point. Maybe we're just doing a better job. Maybe the agency has and the districts have been working hard on a multi-tiered system of support, which gets to what Annette is talking about, where you are being more inclusive in the school. You're wrapping more services around kids, whether or not they're on IEP or not. You're trying to get them what they need using your specialists showing some promise. And one of the reasons why folks are talking about changing the funding system to allow more flexibility so we can do more of that.
Dave Sharp, go ahead. Jump in there.
Well, I would like to add there's two really exciting pilot projects going on in the state. The SWIFT pilot project, I think, is happening in two schools or school districts. And that's where it deals with younger students. So we're trying to work with students before they get a label on them as an IEP, which might be stigmatizing in some way, yet on the other hand, need services, and work with them with classroom aides so aides aren't assigned one-on-one with students, and it's project-based education in the early years. And that's producing some exciting results that we have to look at next year and see if we want to move forward with that. The other is a consultant out of Massachusetts called the District Management Council is doing really exciting work in Chittenden South and maybe up in Ned Kirsch's area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they are working on best practices that have been demonstrated in other parts of the country. And an example of that is that sort of the traditional practices in Vermont is to have one speech and learning professional work with one student at a time. And when you consider that it's speech and language that they're dealing with, isn't it better to have a number of people involved in a conversation? The evidence is that one teacher working with three or four or five speech and language challenged children is actually does a better job for the children, and the cost savings is significant. So these kinds of progress, this kind of progress in these two pilots is exciting. And our bill that will be on the floor on Thursday forwards both of these ideas.
Yeah, and offers grants to schools who want to participate in this kind of pilot program to try to get to best practices and change up the way they're doing things. I want to get another call in here if we can from Jean in Rutland County. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a parent of a child with special needs with significant disabilities, and we benefited greatly from the inclusion model. We had some wonderful teachers and team members that were able to include our son in a great capacity during those early years here in Rutland County. And unfortunately, we did have some behaviors as our son aged up, and he's now in an out-of-state placement in New Hampshire. And I just would like to say that I think restriction and seclusion is very damaging to our children, and we have to really make sure that we take those considerations. And also, we need a model that supports kids here in Vermont instead of sending them out of state, something that mirrors what he's getting in New Hampshire because he's thriving.
Thank you for your call, Jean, and for sharing your experiences. Ned Kirsch, you know, following up on what Jean says and sort of thinking about the big picture here as we wrap up this discussion, what works and what doesn't, and how are what you're looking at with district management council and in your own supervisory union, you know, trying to get to making kids successful and, you hope, saving the supervisory union some money?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to be clear. We did a study with the district management council last year for 3 months to give us a baseline of information about how we can be more successful with all of our students. So I applaud that that's going to be rolled out as a model for other schools. I'd like to be part of that grant because we kind of paid for that through our own our own money. So, and we'd like to continue the work with District Management Council, but we haven't been able to afford that, the next phase of it. Really, they pointed out to us where we were not serving our students the best we could. We need a better way to look at our service delivery across the SU. We need to better manage our staff, which is, goes to the 1-to-1 or the 3-to-1 ratios. And we really need to understand all the needs of our students and that what our system can provide around specialists and really high-quality first instruction.
You think so you can do that with the money you have in your supervisory union now?
Yeah. I mean, we know we're not getting any more. It's just a – or probably we'll get less, but it's really about a reallocation of what we do and looking at exactly what we do that doesn't make sense anymore. And that's – and again, it's a culture. We didn't build that culture in a year, and we're not going to dismantle that culture in a year. It's going to take several years to get to where we want to be.
Ned Kirsch is the superintendent of Franklin West Supervisory Union. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Talbot is chief financial officer for the Vermont Agency of Education. Bill, I appreciate your time today.
You're welcome.
And David Sharp is an Addison County Democrat and the chair of the House Committee on Education. We will be following that bill on special education as it moves through the legislature. Dave Sharp, thanks very much to you.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Coming up, it's not just snowbirds heading up from the south to Vermont. A small, colorful, actual bird called a painted bunting has shown up in Pittsfield, and it's got the birding community all a-Twitter. More on that next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont has a rare celebrity guest who's been attracting a lot of attention and admirers this past week, a painted bunting. The small and very festively colored bird has been hanging out in Pittsfield, and many Vermont birders have been making the trek to see it in person. Kent McFarland is a conservation biologist and co-host of VPR's Outdoor Radio, and he's one of the people who's seen this rare bird. Hi, Kent.
Hi, how's it going, Jane?
Great. Tell me about a painted bunting. What does it look like?
Well, the best description I've heard is it's actually a rainbow on wings. The thing is unbelievable. It's almost gaudy looking. It's got a blue head, a blue that you can't imagine, a really bright red breast and belly, and then it's got these sort of yellow and green tinges on its back. I mean, it really is a rainbow on wings.
So when you see it, it's striking to see. It was a neat thing to actually see in Vermont.
Oh, you know, it's so brown out right now. There's no snow. And as soon as that bird hopped up on a fence at a bird feeder, it was just in your face and everybody was oohing and aahing. It was really remarkable.
Where do they usually live, if not here?
Well, there's two populations, two breeding populations. One of them is in the southeastern United States along the coast in South Carolina, Georgia, Florida area. And then there's a larger population in Texas, Oklahoma region out west. And right now, most of those are probably wintering in Mexico and Central America and down in the Caribbean. So, you know, they're far from here. They're in much more pleasurable weather.
Well, given that, what is this bird doing in Pittsfield?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is actually the sixth record for Vermont. So we found them here five other times. The first one was in 1993 down in Danby, and then there's been on other occasions, including one near Burlington. And all of them have been at bird feeders. And, you know, the best guess is that they just take little trips northward for some reason. Maybe their compass is a little off and, you know, sometimes they might regret it when they get here when it's too cold. For example, there was one in January on a Christmas bird count in western Maine, of all places. And there was a famous one in Brooklyn this winter that everyone went and saw. So, you know, this is one of those species that just for some reason loves to wander northward occasionally.
But still, what did you say, six records in Vermont? It's been spotted and confirmed six times. That's still not very many.
No, it's not very many at all. And that's why when, you know, when Judith Holly found this at her bird feeder in Pittsfield, you know, the bird watchers flocked there literally. On Saturday, there were literally 150 bird watchers there watching this bird. And she was such a sweetheart to let everybody, you know, have access to this bird and see it. It was really quite amazing.
There is some concern being expressed, though, that all of this attention on this bird and so many people visiting it might stress it out. Is that a concern that you share?
Well, you know, when I was there, the bird watchers were really, really good about that. We all stayed far back away from the bird feeder. The bird was sunning itself on a fence, and it was going to the bird feeder to get food to stay warm and healthy. And nobody ever really approached it that quickly, you know. Most bird watchers are really careful about that. You know, they don't want to disturb the bird. They want to be able to enjoy it without making it, you know, feel frightened or anything. So I don't think that in this case that was an issue whatsoever. Everyone was really respectful.
And this is one area where your photography skills come in handy and your high-powered camera that you can get up and close, up
yes.
close and personal with your camera, not with your body.
Exactly. Everybody that had big lenses had them out, and they were trying to get good shots. And that's the great thing about bird watchers. They, for the most part, they really are very more concerned about the bird than they really are about, you know, the great shot.
I'm talking with Kent McFarland, a conservation biologist and co-host of VPR's Outdoor Radio. And we're talking about a very rare bird, at least in these parts, a painted bunting. There's one individual that's been hanging out in Pittsfield. And as Kent has pointed out, a lot of people are getting a chance to go see this bird. It's not a bear. Because it is so colorful and so rare here. But Kent, I understand that this one's also injured. It has something wrong with its foot. So... Is it likely to make it?
You know, that's a good question. You know, I did notice right away when it was sitting there that it was hanging its right leg down a little bit, and it favored its left leg and didn't like to land on its right leg. It looked like there was, you know, some sort of prior injury to its foot. Didn't have mobility of its foot at all. You know, I've seen birds really that can carry on for years like that. There's actually a painted bunting in Connecticut, in southern Connecticut.
Right
out
now.
Of its range also. Right now. That's been coming to a bird feeder for 2 years with its left foot injured. So, you know, sometimes, you know, as long as their wings are doing well, sometimes they can really get by with a hurt or injured leg as long as it doesn't get infected or anything. And it didn't look like this leg was infected or anything. You know, the thing the bird looked was cold, to be quite honest with you. It sat on that bird feeder in the sun all, with its feathers all puffed up and just looked kind of miserable. Like, gosh, why did I come this far north?
Well, then you have to kind of feel bad for it. This is a male bird, right? And it's spring. And here he is all by himself in Vermont when he should be, what, in South Carolina or Florida?
Yeah, he should be in much warmer climates. In fact, the first morning that a bird watcher was there, Sarah Carline, who is a great bird watcher in Vermont, she actually was the first one to photograph it. And she heard it singing on Thursday morning.
Hmm.
So, you know, it is getting ready for spring. It was tuning up. So hopefully, you know, it hasn't been seen since Sunday night now. So hopefully it's turned around and headed back southward and we'll find a fine female to mate with this spring.
There's no chance it could have found a similar species in Vermont and had a little interbreeding?
No, probably not. I mean, we do have a closer relative, the indigo bunting, which is a pretty common bird in Vermont. They're not back yet. They're still on their wintering grounds, but they'll be arriving this spring. And for those of you that haven't seen an indigo bunting, I mean, you really want to get your eyes on this bird. It's one of our more common native birds here, and it really is indigo. I mean, it's a blue that just makes you want to cry. It's unbelievably gorgeous. And so if you want to set your eyes on a bunting, you're liable to see an indigo bunting come May.
Is the blue on the indigo bunting that same beautiful, almost unimaginable blue that you mentioned on the head of the painted bunting, or are they different looks?
They're a little bit different. The painted bunting is a little bit darker blue. Indigo bunting is a little sort of a sky blue almost. Not quite like a bluebird, but you know, it's indigo. I don't know the way to describe it. It's really amazing.
Well, we have a link actually to Kent's picture that we'll put up on our webpage so that you can see this bird in all of its glory and how Kent captured it. aside from the fun factor and that excitement and the sort of paparazzi feel of having this bird around, and as you said, you know, dozens if not 100 birders out there on the weekend photographing and looking at this bird, is there anything else exciting or important about having this bird in Vermont right now?
Well, it's always nice to have a bird like this show up and everybody get excited about nature in general. I mean, we have a lot of birds that are more common, like the indigo bunting here, that are just as amazing. So I'm just happy to have this sort of messenger come by and get everyone just really excited about nature in Vermont.
Kent McFarland is a conservation biologist and co-host of VPR's Outdoor Radio. Thanks for getting us excited, Kent.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Tomorrow on the program, a hurricane slammed into New England in 1938, killing hundreds and devastating the region. On the next Vermont edition, we'll talk about the impact of the hurricane here in Vermont, where it had long-lasting effects on the economy and the landscape itself. You can send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Liam Connors directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.